right in. Pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. Proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games and Collins Epic War Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Castle Panic from Fireside Games, as well as The Adventurers and The Pyramid of Horus from Fantasy Flight Games. Jeff will be reviewing High and Tight from Victory Point Games, Thunderstone Heart of Doom from AEG, and High Noon Saloon from Slugfest Games. We'll have news, views, and more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now, here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
Yes, you are. Hello, my friend. How are you?
Hey, man. Pretty good. Pretty good.
Hey, man. Pretty good. Pretty good.
I'm a little mellow, you know.
You're so. A little bit country. I'm a little bit rock and roll. What can I tell you?
I'm a little bit Memphis and Nashville. I got a little bit of lowdown in my soul. I remember that whole song, man.
Please don't sing the entire song, though.
Okay, fine.
So how was your Thanksgiving?
Wow. I don't even remember it.
Really?
Oh, that was good. We ate a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's what Thanksgiving's all about.
Duffed ourselves and gave thanks. And it was nice.
Nice.
How'd yours go?
I just went out to dinner with my mom. So that was about the extent of it. Wasn't a whole lot of excitement. But I had helped her move a few days prior to that. So it was sort of, she wanted to get back home to keep unpacking stuff. And I spent enough time with her the past few days. So it was fine. Plus, I was in the middle of doing stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, I'm doing
stuff.
Okay?
It's not like it was Christmas. It's Thanksgiving. Come on.
It's the poor man's Christmas.
Yeah, very poor man. Plus, you know, it's only my mom and I out here anyway, so it's not like there was a whole bunch of family and stuff like that. So
we had another governor go to prison.
In Illinois, yes, that's right. I think it's 5 out of the last 6.
Yeah, we're running quite a streak. 14 years Blagojevich got.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm thinking there should be a game, like the Illinois governor prison game or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So up to 6 players, one of them doesn't end up in prison.
Right. Gets away with all the cash.
That's right. Well, if we're talking about Illinois news, Ron Santo got voted into the Hall of Fame, finally, by the...
He did.
Yes, special committee. I got a little teary-eyed when I heard the news.
Yeah. It was well-deserved. He was a great guy.
Yeah. The only thing that really irritates me is how long it took to finally get him into the Hall of Fame. And he had just passed away a year ago, right around Thanksgiving. And are you trying to tell me that his stats changed in the last 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? Nothing changed. His career was still the same. Why did they have to wait until he was dead and couldn't enjoy the honor when they could have done this 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, so that irritated me a little bit. But anyway, shall we move on to gaming-related news?
Hey, I think we should.
I think we should, too.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France. Flash.
I can't remember if we mentioned this on the podcast. I know you did a news piece on the website, but since I'm going to be reviewing Castle Panic on this show...
On this show?
This very show, I thought it prudent to mention that the Wizard's Tower, which is the first expansion to Castle Panic, has been released and is available. The Wizard's Tower adds new monsters and, of course, a Wizard's Tower, which replaces one of the regular towers that you normally use. Mm-hmm. It's got a deck of Wizard's cards that give you special magical abilities to help you defeat some of the newer, stronger monsters. You can hurl fireballs and catch some of those baddies on fire, but then again, some of them can fight fire with fire. There's a nice cloth monster bag, plus the expansion features new boss monsters that can take up to 5 hits. If you've played Castle Panic, you know that the monsters only have 3 sides and 3 hit points that you keep track of by turning the tokens. Mm-hmm. So how do you handle up to 5 hits? Ingeniously, of course, the bosses have Harbinger tokens with the standard 3 corners. If you draw one of these from the monster bag, then you pull out the corresponding 5-sided or pentagon-shaped, as we say in the biz, boss monster and add them to the board. They promised a lot of problems for the defenders.
No!
The expansion looks great.
Start boiling that oil.
And I'm looking forward to playing, and I'll have a review up soon.
Nice.
Since I'm just getting Castle Panic up now.
You know? Right, yeah. You're not going to review the Wizard's Tower first.
Right.
Hey, by the way, I'll tell you what I think of the original game after this.
We'll be right back.
Rallyman and the Rallyman Dirt expansion are landing in stores this week. They're available only through Game Salute select stores, so you might want to check to see if your friendly local gaming store is signed up as a select store or not. Have you ever wanted to be a race car driver? Put your skills to the test in a game of Rallyman.
Rallyman.
It's a board game for 1 to 4 players aged 9 and up. It's a simulation of rally racing or road rallies and includes all the ingredients that give this discipline its flavor of danger and excitement. You won't need a driver's license. You just need to be able to count to 5 in order. Wait a second.
That puts me out.
Me too.
I had to have specially made 5-sided dice.
That's right. I just, you know, 1, 2, 7, 9. Anyway, anybody else out there just needs to be able to count up to 5 in order to deal with the 5 gears of your micro rally car. As I mentioned, it's a Game Salute exclusive, so if your store isn't a Game Salute select store, go to gamesalute.com to see if you can get your hands on a copy.
Rallyman Dirt?
Yep. Guess off-track racing?
Sounds like.
Well, because a lot of the road rallies, that's big in Europe. It's not big here in the U.S., road rallies, who can do it the fastest or whatever. Some of them are 24 hours of driving and things like that. Like I said.
Like the speed racer type.
Sort of. Yeah, exactly. Except they don't have, they don't have that like monster car with that really bizarre sound effect. And the terrible animation.
Uh-huh.
But I believe that Chim Chim comes with the game.
But Speed would never know that Racer X was really his brother.
Ever. Even though he looked exactly like Speed, except a bit taller. Thank goodness for that mask.
Sid Saxon's Bazaar is now available again, with a new printing from Griffin Games. Originally published in 1967. This new version is for 2 to 6 players ages 8 and up. In Bazaar, through skillful trading and retrading, each player attempts to gain the right combination of colored stones from the bank to purchase wares displayed in the bazaar. Values of the various wares are determined by the number of stones the purchaser holds following his transaction. Trading is governed by the current rates posted at the exchange. When all the wares from 2 of the stalls have been sold, the bazaar is closed, the game ends, and the player with the highest score wins.
My God, you sound so excited about this.
Is it unbelievable?
I've never heard of a game anywhere like this.
The game includes 100 colored glass stones to represent the gems that are traded. This game is number 12 in the bookshelf series and is available at an MSRP of
$39.99. Any car, any color, $39.99. Here at Earl Scheib. WizKid Games is adding Lord of the Rings to their HeroClix line, and it's finally arriving in stores.
Moot.
You can choose from campaign-style box sets or the classic HeroClix blind booster format. Recreate the battles of Middle-earth with the included maps and rules that come in each box set. Assemble your fellowship and embark upon your epic quest to destroy the Ring of Doom. Or call forth your cabal of minions of the eye and seek to forever engulf Middle-earth in the shadow of Sauron the Deceiver. It'll feature new epic abilities and campaign rules, and it captures the fantastic action and depth of the beloved movie trilogy, according to HeroClix, of course.
Let alone the actual book trilogy.
It was based on books?
Yeah, didn't you know?
I don't read. Reading's boring.
Reading's for nerds.
Yeah, nerds read. Yeah. Play as Aragorn, Legolas, Gandalf, Saruman, or even Sauron himself. How would you play Sauron?
Do they have a big eye?
Yeah, exactly. Just kind of move it around all the time, so, you know, like in the movie, or it's always looking. What's that over there? What's that? Huh? Huh? I think Sauron had ADD. couldn't keep himself focused in one spot for more than like 10 seconds. Anyway, HeroClix Lord of the Rings is 100% compatible with other HeroClix. As we joked before, you can take on Spider-Man and Superman and so forth, I guess.
Right. Sauron.
With Sauron,
Spider-Man.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's actually a limited edition 6-issue story arc coming soon for Marvel. But, I wasn't supposed to mention that. Sorry. Oh.
Speaking of Lord of the Rings.
The movies, Polish. Right? Not the books. Totally different, right?
Totally different. If we have any of our Polish gamer friends still listening to the podcast, there is some good news. Ares Games and Galacta announce a partnership to publish the Polish edition of War of the Ring 2nd Edition. If we have any of our Polish gamer friends still listening to the podcast,
oh,
there is some good news.
Oh, come on. It was just one little joke. It wasn't even about the Poles.
Hey, Mamimi po polsku?
No, I
Ares...
don't.
Me neither. The long-awaited board game, which has just debuted in its English version, is going to be published in several more languages in the spring of 2012. Ares Games has already announced the partners for the other three international editions, Devir in Spain, Heidelberger Spielver
yeah, them.
In Germany, and Red Glove in Italy.
Red Glove?
The new part.
Wait a second. Isn't Ares an Italian company?
Actually, yeah, they are. I don't know why they...
Yeah.
Hey, don't ask me.
I don't know either. I'm just curious.
The new partner, Galacta, is the leading Polish publisher of games of fantasy and sci-fi board and card games. We are glad to take part in such a great project as War
what
of the
Ring. What is that? Now that's insulting. Now you're doing some sort of a... We just want to tell everybody out there that not only do we have the new War of the Ring game coming out, but we've got plenty of pasta.
I was trying to do Polish. How would...
Oh, I thought you were doing the Ares announcement.
For the life of me, I can't recall a Polish accent, although I worked with...
But you're busting my chops for a Polish comment, and then you're sitting there...
We are glad to take part in such a great project as War of the Ring.
Now, that sounds like something from... No, yeah, it was like from a Godzilla movie.
There are many fans of Tolkien's trilogy in our country, and we believe that they will find many great experiences during their play sessions with this game. Said Darius Wazkiewicz, the CEO of Galacta.
Now you're saying that choosing this news piece is a big mistake.
Yes. I guess I need a pronunciation thing before I talk about anything, really. Again, this new second edition of War of the Ring will be available in German, Spanish, Italian, and now Polish in the spring of 2012.
Are you through insulting the rest of the world?
I think I've done my fair share.
Okay, good deal. Nice. Do you have an order in for War of the Ring in English?
The second edition?
Yeah.
Nah, you know, I got the... Oh, they're offering an upgrade kit for...
For people who have the original, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm thinking about picking that sucker up.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. DarkCon is coming. Based in
DarkCon.
DarkCon. DarkCon.
Oh, sorry.
If it was DorkCon, you'd be doing the news.
I've been going to that one for years.
Based in the Phoenix, Arizona metro area, or where I otherwise call home, Mesa, Arizona, DarkCon is one of the Southwest's premier fantasy and steampunk conventions. DarkCon is known for offering an eclectic mix of workshops, gaming, demos, guests, parties, and special events. The upcoming show promises to be the largest yet. Gaming at DarkCon 2012 opens on Thursday, January 12th at 2 p.m. and runs 24 hours a day until Sunday at 11 p.m. There will be board and card games, role-playing games, live-action role-playing, electronic gaming, gaming tournaments, and also an extensive game library available. The Guys Knights will bring in their crew to run games like Doom, Dixit, Ticket to Ride, and many others. The Men in Black will be in attendance as well with prize support for Steve Jackson Games. These will include Munchkin, Revolution, and GURPS. A variety of collectible card games including Magic, Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon.
Oh,
thank the Lord for those. Are anticipated as well. The 24-hour gaming area is 5,000 square feet of games.
Square inches.
Yes.
You'll have to calculate that out for yourself.
You guys can play in this 20 square foot area here, and please do not leave that. Role-playing games are going to have a large presence with legendary designer Ken St. Andre running the venerable Tunnels and Trolls, Time Renegades by Dennis Kaufman, John Wick with his Houses of the Blooded, and Todd Van Hooser's Laughing Moon Chronicles. Ooh, Laughing Moon Girls, anyone?
Yes.
Yes. You ever see any of those?
Laughing Moon Girls?
Yeah.
I have not, actually.
Google it. It's safe for the family, but if you like pretty girls, you'll dig it.
Well, I do like pretty girls.
Your wife's not listening, so you're okay.
I know. I don't think she's listened to a show yet.
Good deal. There you go. That's nice. DirtCon promises fun for the entire family. And stay tuned, because I'll have more info about the convention, as well as in-depth coverage from the show.
What, you're going?
What, am I not allowed to? It's right here in Mesa.
Ah, jeez. Well, I guess if I can go to the Chicago Toy and Game Fair.
Yeah.
You can go to a real game convention.
Well, it's a steampunk kind of convention. So, and I met the person who's running the actual gaming portion of it. So I'm hoping to maybe put together a bit of an interview for one of podcast extras.
Extra. Sounds cool.
January 12th. So is it okay if I go?
Yeah, I guess.
The 15th. Can I, hey, is it all right? Do I need a note from
is
you?
Is it in the budget? I mean, come on.
Is it in the budget?
Let's see. Is that $0 again this month?
You're right.
In another language translation piece of news, the Settlers of Catan novel by Rebecca Gable, written in 2005, is now available for the first time in English from Amazon.com. Received well by German fans of the game, the novel is set in the year 850. In the seas of northern Europe, the small coastal village of Esselund falls prey to marauding neighbors. Their food stores pillaged, women and children stolen, livestock raped.
Livestock gets raped? What the hell kind of book is this?
I was wondering if you would catch that. Sorry, livestock destroyed. That's what I meant.
Yeah, okay.
So Candemir and Osmond lead their people on an epic quest to a mythic island home. But without knowledge of exactly where the island is, they must trust the gods to deliver them to safety. Lost at sea and set adrift, a violent storm washes them ashore on the island famed in pagan lore, Catan. They quickly set about building a new society, but old grudges, animosities, and social orders lead to fraternal strife. As the ideals of Candemir's Christian slaves spread throughout the village, it's these words that keep throwing me off. There's too many words. When both
Damn, those, that's what I told you, man. Reading is for losers.
As the ideals of Candemir's Christian slaves spread throughout the village and conflict with pagan law, the two belief systems clash. When both Osmond and Candemir fall in love with Sieglind, the sea monster.
Osmonds are in it?
Yes, the Osmonds. Hey, if you're a fan of the board game, now's your chance to look a little deeper into the world of Catan and the Catan novel. Official Catan novel of the 2012 Catan Championship.
Well, I'm very glad you gave me the plot synopsis, so now I don't have to read it. Oh, hey, notes. By the way, if you weren't aware of this, I'm actually working on my novel inspired by tic-tac-toe.
Are you really?
It's just like a Catan novel. Come on, people.
Hey, you know, I just finished the Ghouls of the Miskatonic. The first in the trilogy.
Oh, yeah, right. The FFG novel.
Yeah, I actually just finished it today. And I got to say, it was pretty good. And it had a lot of little, of course, it's all
crafting. I know why you liked it.
Because of Arkham Horror?
Because Ashcan, Pete, and Duke were in it.
That's right. They were.
Yep. That's the only reason. If they weren't in it, you'd be like, man, this was a steaming pile of crap that I had to struggle through all 250 pages of.
Yeah, and it wasn't bad. I got my little ally card in the mail just a couple days ago.
Nice.
Oliver Grayson ally card. So he'll be joining our next
He'll be
adventures.
Marked for doom like the rest of your characters in right. Arkham Horror.
Marked for death. Steven Seagal, the new ally.
Asmodee pulls the plug on Hatari. I know Atari? In a previous episode, you had talked about the Japanese game of bluffing and deception. Yep. Well,
so they were deceiving us?
Yes, it was all a very clever canard. I guess issues with component quality as well as other production concerns has led Asmodee to cancel the upcoming release of Hatari. Ugh. I'm upset. I don't know about you.
Oh, are we
current
fine?
Copies? Do you want a moment? Do you need a minute?
No, it's fine. Just go.
Are you sure?
No, really.
Okay. Current copies of the Japanese game of deception and bluffing are plagued with inconsistencies in card patterns as well as problems with components not holding up to repeated play. The game just was coming out. So how bad could those components be if they fell apart after just a few plays? And it's a card game. Were the cards just regular, like, printer
paper?
There's no word if or when a new release will be scheduled. But for those who currently have purchased the copy, they've been assured of replacement components being provided. This isn't very good news for Asmodee because they recently got slammed in Ted Allspach's Bored to Pieces comic strip, back the December 1st edition. It's a pretty funny little comic strip. It's over on Opinionated Gamers.
Yeah.
And it basically talks about if you're a game designer, want to get a game published that nobody's going to play, have it published by Asmodee. It's funny because it's kind of true.
Come on, what about Quebec?
It's not even out yet.
It's not?
No, it hasn't been released yet. It probably appeared at Essen, but I haven't heard of it being available here in the U.S. yet.
I ain't heard nothing either.
You hear about these games coming out, and then you never hear anything again. Granted, there's some titles out there that are big hits for Asmodee, but
yes.
You know, some Seven a lot wonders. Of times and we'll report it. We'll say, hey, we hear, like for an example, Hatari is coming. Never heard of it before. Even if it came out, we probably wouldn't hear anything about it.
It's true. Sad, yep. True. Empires of the Void from Ryan Lucott completed its run on Kickstarter this week with 239% funding.
Ching.
One of the top 10 most funded games ever on Kickstarter. This game features 2 to 4 players who compete to expand their empire in a vast, diverse galaxy. Each time a player reaches a new planet, he must decide whether to conquer it and strip its land of resources, or befriend the natives and obtain their special ability. With 7 starting alien races to choose from and 15 more to conquer or befriend on a variable board, no two games will be the same. The game uses an action point system and exciting dice-rolling combat with plenty of tactical decision-making, which is similar to Nexus Ops. There are 19 technologies to research that break the rules and change gameplay. Players must use negotiation and trade, even when it's not their turn, which ensures that there's very little downtime. A random event deck helps build the story of the game, as each round something new happens. Usually galaxy-wide. The game lasts around 2 to 3 hours and has intuitive rules which are easy to teach. Look for the game to be published coming up in 2012, and I'll get a more definite date when that info becomes available.
Ta-da! You mentioned Kickstarter, and on our last show, I went into a fairly long, I guess we would say, tirade.
Yes.
About Kickstarter. And I did get a comment. In fact, it's funny. It's the only comment that we have on the site for that show regarding that. And I'm just going to read it real quick, and then I'm going to respond because I know I mentioned some of the reasons why I don't think Kickstarter is good for the hobby. I guess some people didn't catch what I was saying. So I was going to go into a little more detail, but I'll make it as fast as possible. Anyway, the comment person's handle, nickname is, do you want me to wait while you eat your nerds?
I'm sorry.
It's like, the person's nickname is Jobin13. They wrote, Jeff, I'm not a business person and I do not know what you do for a living, but I have to say your pneumonia-induced rant. Not pneumonia, anyway. I already had mentioned that it was valley fever. Ha ha. Shows how much people pay attention. About how dumb every single person on Kickstarter is really rubbed me the wrong way. I also disagree with your sentiment that companies with money should not be on Kickstarter at all. Business is about making money. Kickstarter is a way for companies to minimize risk and make more money so they can make more games. That sounds great to me. Sometimes some of the best products come from the biggest risks. Using Kickstarter companies and take bigger creative risks while protecting their own security as a viable business. That's what he wrote. I'm just reading it. A chance at better, more exciting games without having to see game companies go under? I'm all for that. And you said several times that Kickstarter is terrible for the hobby. You said, quote, Kickstarter is terrible for the hobby, end quote, many times. However, not once did you say, quote, Kickstarter is bad for the hobby because, end quote. I'd like to hear why you think Kickstarter is so bad for the hobby. The market will support what it can support. As more people find their way to this wonderful hobby, more games will be published to meet demand. Of course, games will fail every year. It's rare for a market's demand to outweigh its supply. It's also always the other way around. Why is it you seem to believe that the more games that are published, the worse off we all are? Choice is good. More choices is not always better, but I believe that in this case, where the market is expanding fairly rapidly, variety, quantity, and inevitably, quality are all good things to help bring in even more people. All right. Well, so, Joman13, let me respond, and I'm going to point this out. I am in business. I have spent my entire career in business of some sort. So, yes, I understand how business works. Now, you talk about choice is a good thing. Ask the comic book industry how good more choice is for them. Seeing that the industry almost collapsed in the early 1990s due to the glut of product that was out there. Back in the day, the top-selling comic titles used to sell about a half million, about 500,000 titles. Today, even with all the Hollywood movies helping to promote their properties, the top-selling comics sell about 170,000. The comic book industry is in bad, bad shape. You may not realize that, but it is. Same is true for the video game industry. I'm sure everybody's thinking, wow, video game companies, they're making fistloads of money and everybody should get into gaming. And I see these commercials where I can go and I can study to be a game designer. Do you know how many game design companies, video game design companies closed shop this year? And some of them were actually big names who put together big name games. So no, quantity is not a good thing. We've already discussed there were 750 or so games released at Essen. Now, let's say over the course of the year, 250 board games go on to Kickstarter. That's 1,000 games. Your average gamer can't purchase 1,000 games a year. And let's be very honest, of those 1,000 games, maybe 10%, maybe 100 of them are actually going to be pretty decent games that you'd want to put on your shelf. Can the average gamer out there afford to purchase 100 games in a year? Absolutely not, at least not the people I know. Most of the gamers I know, they can afford to purchase maybe one game a month. Some months, maybe they splurge and buy two. So let's say your average gamer out there, the vast majority of gamers, can purchase anywhere between 15 and 20 games in a year. Can the market survive that with 1,000 new games coming out each and every year? I highly doubt that. Plus, you have to keep in mind, most of these games are just rehashes of something else. Now, the issues I have with Kickstarter are a few. Number one, I've said before, yes, the big companies shouldn't be on Kickstarter because Kickstarter is not for them. It really isn't. It's for the small guy. It's for the Collins Epic War Games, those kind of companies, or the first-time publisher who's never produced the game who has a great idea. That's one of the issues I have with Kickstarter. Everybody jumped on Kickstarter following the success of Alien Frontiers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality of it. Everybody saw what that did and said, hey, you know what? I can do that. Well, probably not, because keep in mind, Clever Mojo Games was already backing Alien Frontiers. They had a publisher who was already in their corner, who was going to help them once the funding was reached. The vast majority of people on Kickstarter with games do not have that in place. And I did an interview recently with Byron Collins over at Collins Epic War Games, and we discussed that a little bit. So you'll be able to hear that in a few days. So that's one of the issues. The other issue I have with Kickstarter is anybody can put together a great promotion. I could sit there and put together an ad that would make a game look like, wow, this is the greatest thing since Oxygen. Does that really mean that the game is going to be that good? With Kickstarter, you don't have anybody out there like us or the Dice Tower or Opinionated Gamers or Board Game Geek. You don't have anybody out there who's able to see this stuff before it's out there on the market for you to buy. Who can say, hey, you know what? This is a good game, or really enjoy this game, or you know what? Maybe it's not a very good game.
That's the thing. You're right. You don't know beforehand.
You don't.
Before it even exists.
It reminds me of the old joke. You and I used to kid around and use this line all the time. And I think it was from a pinball game. It would play, you pay your money, you take your chances. And that's exactly what Kickstarter is. There's no guarantee that that game's going to be any good. But there's also no option out there to find out what the game is like. Now, I have seen other websites out there write reviews of games that are on Kickstarter. In my opinion, I think that's kind of disingenuous because they're writing a review of something that's not on the market, nor are they actually playing the copy that would be available for sale.
Now, that's like something beta copies or something?
Yeah, or print and play, things like that. Yeah. For an example, I did the review for 1955, The War of Espionage.
Yeah.
That was not the finished product that I received. It was as close to the actual final product. So I felt, okay, can feel good about reviewing this. Whereas other things, we get offers all the time to, you know, do reviews of things that are still in kind of a beta stage, things that are not, have not gone to print. And we take a pass. We tell these developers all the time, you know what? Well, we're more than happy to do a review, but you got to get us something where we can tell people, hey, this is what the finished product is going to be, or this is very, very close to the finished product.
That's true. Well, I'm a component junkie, so.
Well, yeah, I know that. I don't think it's fair to our listeners or our readers if we're reviewing things that, let's be honest, this isn't what's going to be on the store shelf or what you're going to get in the mail when you place your order.
I know. I ripped up my review of Hatari.
Yeah, there you go. The component just couldn't hold up to those 3 times you played the game. So that's what I want to say. That's my big issue with Kickstarter. I at no point said every single person on Kickstarter was dumb. And for Jobin 13 specifically, it might be a good idea for you to actually pay attention to what I'm saying on the show before you decide you're going to make me look like an in the comment section. So anyway, moving right along. That makes sense to you? That's why I don't like Kickstarter?
Yes, there's nothing wrong with your reasoning. I'm not going to say that I think Kickstarter is completely bad for the hobby because it has brought some good games that would not have otherwise made it to
right.
the publishing
wouldn't have
world.
Seen the light of day. But I'm
but
sure
the sheer
on the
glut
other hand,
of games now that are on it, well, you know, some of them are going to fail and some of them aren't.
Right. You know? As well as everything else that's out there, too. Oh, and the other thing is this guy thinks this hobby is growing. Guess again.
You don't think so?
No, it's not. The numbers aren't there.
I'm going to have to disagree with you this time.
Well, then I'm going to have to send you a couple of links.
I think, is it artificial growth? Is that what you're saying?
There's a few different websites out there that are going to tell you how many copies of stuff is selling, and it's not huge. The exposure of the hobby is growing. The number of gamers out there are not. Because I'll give you a great example. That guy, Louie, that I'll game with, Louie's the one who buys the games. Everybody else plays them. They don't buy them. Just like yourself. Think of how, you know, you and the kids and, you know, Brian, stuff like that. Do they go and buy games?
No.
Or do they just play the games that you get?
No, they don't. I buy the games.
Correct. So, yeah, the hobby's not growing. Not like this guy thinks it is. Based on the hit IDW Publishing comic series from writer Joe Hill. Psst.
Locking.
He's Stephen King's son, by the way.
That's right.
And artist Gabriel Rodriguez, Lock and Key the Game, will be coming from Cryptozoic in January. 3 to 6 players will travel to Lovecraft, Massachusetts to unravel the mystery of Key House. Lock and Key the Game promises cooperative supernatural adventure for all. Come meet the Locke family and take a tour of the mysterious Key House. Locke and Key tells the story of the Locke family and Key House, an unlikely New England mansion that's home to fantastic keys that transform all who dare use them, and a hate-filled creature that will not rest until it forces open the most terrible door of them all. The bathroom door. It's in there.
Woo!
Ah, oh,
man.
Doors.
Close that door.
Competition and cooperation meet in this card game that dares you to overcome the supernatural challenges of Key House. You and your fellow players will face these horrors together, but who will be by your side when the dust settles? On this journey, you'll make decisions on when and where to help your fellow players, but your resources are not endless. Through careful management of your cards, you can help the family overcome challenges, and you'll be rewarded for the assistance. Sometimes.
Hmm.
Ooh, piqued Elliot's interest there, didn't I? Ooh,
it's a
supernatural.
Game.
Yeah, I knew it. Now I know.
And I had no idea this. It's coming out in January. I've never even heard of it. I mean, I've heard of Locke and Key. I've read the comic.
Yeah, that's what it's based on. Very interesting.
Okay, dear Cryptozoic.
To be honest, I've never played a Cryptozoic game.
I don't think I have either. Not that I can think of.
Yeah. No, I can't think of a single one. I know Food Fight looked like that'd be kind of a, I don't want to say cute, but it did look like it would be kind of an interesting card game. And of course, they've got the Walking Dead game, but I haven't heard anything about that yet.
No, I saw it. They had it at Barnes & Noble, believe it or not.
Well, I believe it.
Well, there you go.
Now, the other Walking Dead game, that was the one from Z-Man, was it?
It may be Z-Man. I don't even know.
It's not jumping in my head. Didn't hear good things about it.
Really? Is that the comic book one or the TV show one?
It is the comic book one. Cryptozoic, I believe, is the TV show. Hey, speaking of that,
right?
I was going to say, what are we going to do until February?
Man, you know, what, 6 episodes and then mid-season finale?
Now, wasn't it 7? Seven,
right.
And there's 6 to go?
7. The last episode
Heroes
was
did that
excellent.
When they first started.
Huh?
Heroes, the show on NBC,
yes,
that used to be on NBC, they did that the first season. It was like, what? And a lot of shows do that now.
Mid-season
they go on like
finale.
A little hiatus. Yeah.
So that the stars can go home for Christmas and stuff?
I have no idea why. Maybe the reason behind it is that way the networks aren't paying for the entire season.
Up front.
And they can decide, they can decide if they're going to pull the plug on it early. Say, like, the Playboy Club, which lasted all of, I think, 2 episodes.
Hmm.
Here's a funny little side story about the Playboy Club.
Okay.
I heard that they, back at the time, they were probably going to cancel it. My brother, who does stand-in work and extra work and stuff like that on movies and TV shows, called me up and left me a message saying, hey, I'm going in for an audition for the Playboy Club. And I'm thinking, I thought they're going to cancel it. So sure enough, the day before he's supposed to go in, they pulled the plug on it.
That's bogus.
And my brother left me a message again. Because it was only a few days between these messages. And he's like, yeah, I don't know what's going on. I was waiting for the call to go for the Playboy Club, and I haven't gotten a call back. I'm trying to get a hold of him. So I called him right away. I said, hey, Greg, didn't you hear they canceled the show? He's like, oh, I guess that would explain it.
So, the Metal Gear Solid Collector's Edition of Risk.
What? Huh? What?
USAopoly has just released the Metal Gear Solid Collector's Edition of Risk. In this Metal Gear-themed version, private military companies have taken the place of state armies as the world's primary war machines. As the fires of war continue to spread, take command and wage the ultimate battle for supremacy. Hire one of 8 legendary bosses to lead your soldiers, including Solid Snake, Raiden, and Liquid Ocelot.
Ocelot. Yes. Obviously, you have not played any of the Metal Gear Solid games.
No, I haven't.
I didn't think so. It's Liquid Ocelot.
Thank you.
It's Japanese, man. You know how they are with their games. Give you the craziest names for the characters.
So the game has a customized board and is the first edition to feature a separate mobile territory, the Outer Haven game board in peace. Plus, there are 3 faster variants to play Risk included in the rules for those who just don't have the time for the standard epic length game of Risk.
Come on, it's not that epic.
Well, in comparison to real epic games, maybe not. The edition is available in the U.S. only due to licensing agreements, so you'll have to get someone in the States to pick it up for you and send it along if you're an international fan.
Like in Poland.
Exactly.
The game. I said nothing wrong. I'm just throwing that out there because I knew you would laugh.
The game is available with an MSRP of $39.95.
Along the lines of Risk, I did have an opportunity to play a game of Aikusa from Wizards of the Coast, or is it Hasbro? One of the two. I mean, it's the same difference. Can't do a review of it because I only played it once, but I found it pretty interesting. It probably would have gone a little smoother if the person who, it was their game, but they had never played it before either, didn't have a handle on all the rules to it.
Right.
So we did run into some situations where it was like, really? That's the rule? And I just did this, so now I'm screwed? I thought it was pretty interesting. It's got that kind of Risk element of armies moving across the board. A little kind of Risk, little Axis and Allies. I'd say it's probably right between those two. I enjoyed playing it. I'd like to play it again. And if I can play it two more times, I'll do a review.
Sweet.
My last piece of news isn't really news per se, but I did want to throw a shout out to Reaper Miniatures. People know I'm a big minis fan. Love painting miniatures. I've actually been spending more time lately, thankfully, being able to paint some miniatures. And I just wanted to say, Reaper just seems to always go that extra mile for their customers. I'll give you a great example. At Origins, at Gen Con, they did a special where you just had to come up to the booth and they gave you a special code that you could redeem online. And if you purchased, I believe it was a $25 purchase or more, you'd enter this code and you'd get this swag box. And they did one for Halloween, which I received just out of the blue. It just appeared. I got it in November. Mm-hmm. And I opened it up and I just started laughing because it was 10 paints. And this is all free. They do these freebies where you'll get a code. I'm going to guess that they had ReaperCon recently. So maybe it was a ReaperCon thing. Yeah. So you got 10 paints. I got one of their little mouseling figures. I also got, it's pretty funny, in the same Reaper packaging as their miniatures, and it's Trick or Treat, and it says Trick, all I got was a rock, and there's a rock in it. There were some posters, a Trick or Treat bag with the Reaper logo on it, a Reaper tote, and also it came along with one of those badge holders for when you go to conventions. Uh-huh. You know how you have the, usually you get a lanyard and everything. Well, some companies out there, they have these badge holders. So I got a Reaper Miniatures badge holder, which I thought was very cool. And all of that would have been free with a special code. And they do that all the time.
That's a pretty good size package, actually.
Well, if you think about it, the paints, and I'm just pulling this out of my head. I don't know specifically. I think the paints are $4. The figure's probably a $6 or $7 figure. The rock is no doubt easily $10. The tote bag, kind of tote bag you would see when you go to the grocery store and you buy the little tote bag so you don't use plastic bags. And there was some candy. There was some trick-or-treat candy in the box, too.
Aww.
Yeah, Skittles.
I want candy.
I'm sorry, like Mike and Ike's and some lollipops. I just thought it was really something that was neat. And I thought, this is the kind of stuff that Reaper does. So I definitely, if you're into miniatures, check out Reaper if you haven't. I mean, if you're into miniatures, I'm sure you've been there umpteen times. But if you're thinking about getting into the hobby, I can't say enough about Reaper. Their prices are great compared to other miniature companies out there. Games Workshop. I just want to throw that shout out there and say a big thanks for Reaper for always going the extra mile.
Yeah, that's cool. That is cool. I want candy.
I still have some of it.
You see?
You have nerds. You've been eating nerds while we're recording this, so don't be talking about candy.
Revolver from White Goblin and soon from Stronghold Games is a non-collectible card game for two players by Mark Chaplin, and the game is set in the Old West. Consisting of two balanced 62-card decks, the game pits two players against each other in a life-or-death struggle. One player takes the role of Colonel Ned McReady and his lawman, and his opponent assumes control of the notorious and deadly Colty Gang. At their disposal... Sorry.
Yes? Don't leave me hanging.
At their disposal, the Colty Gang, the meanest bunch of low-down dirty dogs in the West, have a roster of weaponry to bring down the lawman on their tail. 38 specials, 45 long Colts, 1866 double-barrel Derringers, and even a Gatling gun. The Colonel player's objective is to eliminate all the gang members before they can escape across the Mexican border.
Kill them all.
The game has an asymmetrical design, with both decks featuring different cards and abilities. Primarily a combat-driven card game, each player must manage his deck of cards effectively to win. Revolver is played using a five-column system, representing consecutive gunfights in the following battlegrounds: the Bank at Repentance Springs, Whiskey Canyon, Buzzard Point, Rattlesnake Creek, and the 315 Express from Rattlesnake Station. Gameplay is quick, and numerous tricky decisions must be made throughout. So that's Revolver from White Goblin, and soon from Stronghold Games.
So are you trying to tick off our Southern listeners now? Is that
the old wish?
The rootin' shootin' us!
So mean he once shot a man just for snoring.
Time Life Books presents...
The old wished.
Yeah, that's right. Wasn't as exciting as you think it was. Yeah, just a lot of dirt and dust and going hungry and couldn't find any water and yep.
A lot of...
And there were a few guys who shot each other. So anyway... All right. Well, there you have it. There's the news.
Yep, all 6 hours of news.
There you go. Maybe you shouldn't be eating candy while you read it either.
Sorry. You mentioned candy. I just had to have one shot, man. Just one shot.
Yeah, that's not... No, you were eating out long before I started talking about candy.
Right, but not while I was actively speaking.
I needed it, man. Don't you understand? I needed it.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try. A favorite pastime has finally found its way into the ballpark of Victory Point Games Sports Series. High and Tight, from designer Herman Luttman, is a simple game of baseball strategy for two players, utilizing teams to the fullest and going head-to-head in the field. Anywhere from spring training to the intensity of the World Series can be played. It said every baseball team will win one-third of its games and lose one-third of its games. Now step onto the field and find out what it takes to win that other one-third. By the way, that quote is actually from Tommy Lasorda, who was the manager of the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
You can focus on how to best form your team lineup and battle inning by inning in an effort to emerge victorious. Think you have what it takes to efficiently manage your players, maximizing their specific talents as well as utilizing strategy cards to subtly increase the odds of scoring and preventing runs? Well, step up to the plate with High and Tight and let's play ball. As I mentioned, it's designed by Herman Luttman from Victory Point Games, came out just recently this year. It's for two players. Playing time is 60 minutes, although, to be honest, I think you could probably get a game in within about a half hour or so, and is suggested for ages 10 and up. I'm going to begin this review by pointing out High and Tight is a complete departure from what many may consider a traditional head-to-head baseball game. Those who enjoy the hard numbers and simulation as found in Strat-O-Matic, APA, or other such baseball games will find much of the action on the field extremely abstracted here. On the other hand, light gamers who enjoy just a quick card flipping or, dare I say, spinning style basic game might find there's a bit too much under the hood of High and Tight. Yet for fans of America's pastime who want a quick playing game which gives a good feel for baseball and, importantly, produces realistic scores based upon the players on the field, High and Tight may just strike the right chord. It's designed for two players. Honestly, I can't see playing solo as the strategy cards make things a bit tricky.
Don't play that 9-player game.
Well, no, but I mean, a lot of baseball games out there, you could play solo. You have to be pretty fair for the other team. Oh, well, the starting pitcher's getting his butt handed to him. Well, we'll leave him in for a couple more hitters.
Leave him in.
There are four teams included in the game. Fielders are broken down by type, such as infielder, outfielder, or catcher, and DH, and rated in six categories: offense, power, on-base percentage, speed, clutch, and defense. Pitchers are either starters, relievers, or closers and rated in 8 categories. Strikeouts, gopher balls, fatigue, whip, which is walks and hits per inning, clutch, scoring role, and scoring number. So far, all this might sound like standard stuff for those who play stat-based sports games, but there's a big twist. You won't construct your lineup in a traditional way by leading off with your speed player, followed by someone who gets on base a lot and can drop a bunt, followed by your best all-around hitter, followed by a power hitter, and so on. And high and tight, each inning has an appropriate hitting category that's going to come into play. For example, speed comes into play in the first and seventh innings, while on-base percentage is used in the second and eighth innings. The player who's considered in the field for that half inning will be using their pitcher who's on the mound and a selected fielder to try to negate the player at the plate. In other words, the lineup isn't set as each player can draw from available fielders and pitchers. Fielders can only be used once per game, and pitchers are no longer available once they're removed from the mound. Your team must field a lineup that includes one catcher, 3 outfielders, 4 infielders, and a designated hitter. Yes, even National League teams field a DH. Being a Cubs fan, I'm not thrilled with that designated hitter being included in National League lineups, but I'm sure, to me, it's a cheap way of getting around the pitcher.
Right.
And I have seen games out there where everybody has a designated hitter. Well, there is no DH in the NL. But you can make a basic pitcher's hitting chit because you don't have the hitter's cards. You have these little counters.
Okay.
You could easily devise one of those for each player. Now, of course, that means that one inning you'll have a minuscule chance of runs being scored for the offense. But I, for one, I'd be happy with that trade-off. Runs are scored by simple die rolls. When your pitcher takes the mound, you'll set up his stuff on the tracks on the game board. Stuff is the scoring role and scoring number on the pitcher's chit. Suppose Tim Lincecum of the California Titans is on the mound. His scoring role is a 2, while his scoring number is an 8. Now, the scoring numbers happen to be in Roman numerals, just to make things a little different. Because the scoring role and the scoring number, people could easily confuse the two. You can't confuse it if one is a number and the other is a Roman numeral.
Oh, that's true.
This normally means having a scoring role of 2 and a scoring number of 7. Right. I said 8 before. It should have been 7. Sorry. This would normally mean the batter gets to roll twice, looking to roll exactly a 7 on 2 six-sided dice in order to score a run. Because the scoring die roll under that Roman numeral 7 is a 7. If you rolled a 7 both times, that means you'd score 2 runs. There's also a mano-a-mano aspect to the game as the batter's offense is adjusted by the fielder's defense, as the defense is subtracted from the offense. Each player also has a hand of strategy cards that are either for offense or defense. The cards are one of 6 types: power, speed, on-base percentage, OBP, clutch, special, or free. Special strategy cards can be played in any inning, while free cards don't count against the limit of 1 card played per player per half inning. The other cards can be played in the appropriate inning, such as a speed card in a speed inning, or a power card in a power inning. Each team begins the game by drawing 6 cards in any combination of offense or defense, while discarding 1 unwanted card if they'd like, and replacing that. The home team does this first, followed by the visiting player. Depending on the inning, each player will have the opportunity to draw more and exchange more cards. In the 7th and later innings, you'll find that you'll have more options as far as this goes. Let me tie this together a bit. Let's say you're the player managing the Texas Cowboys at home in the 5th inning against the aforementioned California Titans. Mm-hmm. Your starter, A.J. Pilson, is on the mound with his rating of 2/7, normally meaning 2 rolls needed to get a 7 to score a run on either roll. The 5th is a power inning, so you decide to keep Pilson on the mound. He's been putting goose eggs up on the board, and bring in Jack Hampton as your fielder. Now remember, you're the home team. The visitor is at the plate. Your opponent decides he'll bring in Pat Burrell to the plate. Sure, this would also have been a good spot to have Buster Posse, but he was used in the 4th, a clutch inning. Burrell's offense is a 5, while Hampton's defense is a 4. The difference is positive 1, so you move the scoring number up 1 to an 8. You're still getting those 2 rolls, but now you need to roll either a 2 or a 7 to score a run. Now the strategy cards come into play. The Titans player doesn't have any offense cards that are either power or special, so he's stuck. He can't play a card. You, on the other hand, have the power card, Chin Music, in your hand, so you play it. This card subtracts the pitcher's gopher rating from the scoring number. Remember, I mentioned that each pitcher has different ratings as well.
Okay.
So the gopher rating, what that is, gopher balls. It's how many home runs they would normally give up. If somebody gives up a lot of home runs, they have a low gopher rating. If they don't give up many home runs, they'll have a higher gopher rating. Now, because the Chin Music card subtracts that gopher rating and Mr. Pilsen on the mound has a gopher rating of 3, you're now adjusting that scoring number down 3. So you go from an 8 to a 5. So those Titans still get their 2 rolls, but now they need a 5 to score a run. The Titans player rolls a 6 and a 7. Hey, how lucky for you. If you hadn't played Chin Music, the Titans would have scored a run with that 7. But seeing that you did, and they needed 5s, Pilsen retires aside with another 0 on the board. Into the bottom of the 5th, you have Hampton at the plate, because he was the fielder in the top of the inning. Burrell's in the field because he was the batter. This is the mano-a-mano that comes into play. You don't create a lineup, so you don't sit there and say, okay, I've got so-and-so leading off, followed by this player. You'll have a pool of 9 players in your starting lineup that you can choose to play in any inning. Once you've played them, though, they're removed. Follow?
Yeah, I got you so far.
Okay. So we're into the bottom of the 5th. You have Hampton at the plate, Burrell's in the field, and the aforementioned Tim Lincecum is the Titans pitcher, and we already know he's a 2-7. Just as Pilsen before, this means 2 rolls with 7s scoring runs. Hampton's offense is a 6, while Burrell's defense is pretty poor at a 3. So that's positive 3 for Hampton, so the scoring number moves to a 10, which will score runs on 4s and 7s. It's time to take advantage of that Goodwood power card that's been sitting in your hand, so you play that. This adds the batter's power number to the scoring number. Nothing's changed since the top of the 5th, so the Titans can't play a power or special card to counter. Hampton's power is a 3, but the maximum scoring number is 12, so the adjustment's really only 2, but now you have the best rolls to score runs, 6 and 7s. You roll twice and get 7 and 6. Woohoo! Hampton's power has helped the Cowboys break through against the Titans ace with 2 runs.
Huh,
and that would be the end of the inning.
Huh. So you 2 rolls and you're through 1 half of an inning.
Correct.
Two more rolls. And you're
well, there's different cards and things like that that can change the number of rolls you'll get. And it's through these strategy cards.
Okay.
But a lot of times you may not have a strategy card that can be played in that inning. So you would just be doing straight up, this is what the pitcher's stuff is. This is the offense minus the defense. Move it, adjust it up or down. And you would get those 2 rolls. Now, based upon the pitcher themselves, some of them may allow you 3 rolls, 4 rolls. You know, if they're lousy pitchers, they tend to allow you more rolls to score runs off them. The process of playing the inning might sound a little more complex than it really is, but you can get through each full inning in just a few minutes and just a handful of dice rolls. A full game, as I mentioned for myself, I would think only takes about 30 minutes as opposed to 60 once you get the hang of things. And of course, there's rules for pitcher's fatigue and extra innings, as well as optional rules for ballpark effects, resting pitchers, and using closers. In playing high and tight, you can see where the influences of other sports games come into play. Herman Lettman has already stated that he wanted to create something along the lines of Slapshot, or the old Avalon Hill title, Pennant Race, and it certainly does show. There is that whole mano a mano, where just like Slapshot, it's you're using one player versus the other player. And in the old Pennant Race, it was to simulate seasons quickly, and the way I looked at Pennant Race was sort of, you're playing Stratomatic or Appa or Sherco or something like that, and you have your team that you're playing the full games. You could use Pennant Race to quickly simulate all the rest of the action in the league so that you could create really an entire
season,
right, with your wins and losses, things like that, without having to go through playing each and every game through Stratomatic or something. The gameplay is quick enough so you can cruise through a World Series in an evening and still have an overall narrative of each game. Boy, that Jack Hampton, he sure put on a show. No wonder he won the series MVP. Obviously, I have to point out, due to licensing, there are no real player names. There are no real team names. Right. So, of course, we're talking about the California Titans or the San Francisco Giants. The Texas Cowboys are the Texas Rangers. I have to point out, all is not perfect with High and Tight, though. These aren't necessarily criticisms of the game design itself, but they do bear some mentioning. First, as I mentioned, I'm a fan of the National League, so I'm not thrilled with all the teams using a DH. Also, there are only four teams included with the game. There are four additional team cards, such as the Chicago Black Sox, who play in the friendly confines, which that's sacrilege right there.
Right, yep.
But you have these four teams and these four additional team cards, but you're still using the same exact players. There's home team modifiers or negatives applied to the visiting team depending on what ballpark they're playing in, one of these eight team cards. That just doesn't really ring true to me, as ballparks normally play out the same for the home team as it does the visitor. So adding, let's say, a power number to the home team, but not to the visiting team, or such as something like that, it just doesn't seem realistic. If you want to give the home team a bit of an edge, there are what's known as rally cap cards that each team gets. I would probably give the home team just an additional rally cap. Hmm. The home team already has the advantage. They bat last. Also, I'm kind of surprised by the timing of the release of High and Tight.
Right, when baseball season's over.
When I interviewed Herman, that was early spring, and they were hoping to get High and Tight out by the All-Star break. And Herman also had the Tattered Flags Gettysburg game that was coming out. So that came out first, and then High and Tight followed it up. The World Series was already over by the time High and Tight was released.
Yeah.
So the games that are included, or the teams, I should say, that are included in the game are from 2010, from that playoff race.
Right.
Of course, only having the four teams, not real thrilled with that. Of course, I understand they couldn't include all 30 teams. You have 20 players on each team, 10 fielders and 10 pitchers, which I know people are saying, well, wait a second, there's 25 players on the team. Well, the way the game is set up, you don't have pinch hitters, you don't have defensive replacements and so forth. So in reality, 10 fielders feels right. You really need that one guy, the 25th man on the bench who normally comes in to play the outfield in the eighth inning for defensive purposes? Probably not. And that's not really in the whole theme of the game. Overall, I really like High and Tight. Like I said, I just feel that there's a few tweaks here and there that could possibly be made. But then again, I'm kind of a baseball purist. I may not necessarily be the target audience for High and Tight. It's really different, and it's got a nice flow to it. You feel like a game of baseball is going on.
Yeah.
And the final scores are pretty realistic. It's not all of a sudden 17-13 every single game, which some baseball games can play out that way.
Yep.
I would just like to say I'm hoping that VPG decides to release additional teams for the game, and I'll be the first one to tell Herman right here on the show, if you need some help calculating out the players' statistics to get all those teams out there, I'd be more than happy to lend a hand. So there you have it, High and Tight.
High and Tight.
Yes. Yes.
Castle Panic from Fireside Games, which came out in 2009, actually. It's a co-op game for 1 to 6 players, and in this game, you and your fellow players are defending the castle in the center of the board. Around the board are several circular zones, and beyond that is the forest, where wave upon wave of orcs, goblins, and trolls will emerge with the solitary goal of tearing down the castle walls and destroying the towers. Now, to win in Castle Panic, you have to survive with at least one tower still standing and defeat every monster until the pile of monster tokens is empty. To set up the game, you place the 6 tower stand-ups around the center of the board, and beyond this, you place the 6 wall stand-ups. There's lines that emanate from the center of the board all the way to near the edge, forming 6 separate areas. And these areas are split into several other zones. The forest, the Archer Zone, the Knight Zone, and the Swordsman Zone.
They're like rings, aren't they?
Exactly. Like big rings.
Kind of like a dartboard.
Yes. Very good. Yes. And now once a monster gets to the Swordsman Zone, on its next move, it will knock down one of your walls. Then, if it gets further, it'll knock down one of your towers, and then it rotates around inside your castle, destroying tower after tower until the castle is in ruins and the players lose. So you want to stop the monsters as soon as you can. The players are dealt a certain number of cards, which depends on the number of players, and the monster tokens are placed face down in a pile next to the board, after you place the six starter monsters on the board in the Archer Ring. The only way to hurt the monsters is by playing a card that will do damage to them. The monsters all have from 1 to 3 hit points, and you rotate the tokens to show how much each monster has left. You know, each corner has a 1, a 2, or a 3.
So if they have 1, you just would remove the token?
Once they lose that 1, then they're dead and you remove the token.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Exactly. The cards are designed to do 1 point of damage in 1 zone and 1 area. And there's 3 areas. There's red, green, and blue. So you have the circles, and then those are split into 3 separate areas. The way it works is if there's a monster in the green area in the archer circle, then you need a green archer card to do 1 point of damage to that monster. Each turn, you draw up to the max number of cards that you're allowed, which is usually like 5. And then you can discard 1 card and draw a new one. Then you can trade 1 card with another player. After that, you play all the cards that you can, trying to do as much damage as you can to the monsters that are moving closer. And then you would move all of the monsters on the board 1 ring closer to the center. The final step on your turn is that you draw and place 2 new monster tokens in the outer circle, which is the forest. If you allow a monster to get close enough to hit a wall, then that wall is destroyed. Luckily, the monster also takes 1 point of damage. If the monster still lives...
From the falling debris?
Exactly. Well, from slamming itself against a wall.
I guess. I just get to the wall and I explode a little bit of myself to bring down that wall.
If the monster still lives, then it will destroy one of the inner towers on its next move. Walls can be rebuilt on occasion, but towers can't. Finally, if the monster is still alive, it will destroy a tower each turn as it moves clockwise around the center of the board.
No!
It's important to try to prevent the monster from getting to this point because there are very few cards that can damage a monster once it's inside the walls. In fact, there is 1 card that can kill it, 1 card that can drive it back to the forest, and 1 card that can freeze it in place for 1 turn. So you don't have a lot of options there to save yourself.
Right.
You can use a combination of a brick card and a mortar card to rebuild a single wall. There are several cards that can affect a monster in any color, and several that allow you to draw additional cards. With all of this, it may seem like it might be easy to keep the monsters back, but it really isn't. The monster tokens are not all monster tokens. Some of them cause the monsters to move an additional zone.
No!
Yes.
What are they on, speed?
I'm moving into additional zone. Or move to a different color, or cause players to discard a card or cards. And then there are boss monsters. The Goblin King brings 3 additional monsters with him when he comes out. The Orc Warlord causes all the monsters that are in the same color as him to move 1 ring closer to the center. And the Troll Mage causes all monsters to move 1 ring closer to the center. All monsters. The Healer causes all the monsters to heal 1 point of damage when he appears.
That son of a...
Yeah, I know. The co-op aspect of the game is crucial. You can only trade 1 card with another player on your turn, but this card is crucial to plan for, and the players must really work together to plan the best strategy for stopping these ever-advancing monsters. It's not a complicated strategy to plan. If you have a card that will help a player stop a monster, then you trade it to them. They can give you a card in return that might be useful on your turn. It's not a difficult game, and it is a lot of fun. I would suggest it as a gateway co-op game for introducing your preteens or board game newbies to the concept of a co-op game. Castle Panic makes a great family game and gives you that feeling of accomplishment when that final monster is defeated. Every time that you kill a monster, you get to keep the token. And at the end of the game, if the players won, you can add up all of the hit points on your monster tokens to find out who the master slayer is. Or the winner. There's also two variant versions included in the rules, and in the full co-op version, you don't bother to keep monster trophies and there's no Master Slayer, either just the players all win or they all lose. In the Overlord version, one player actually controls the monsters and works to defeat the other players.
While they sit there and they twiddle their handlebar mustache.
Yes. There are some excellent rules for the monster player to be effective. Additionally, there are solitaire rules if you would like to learn how to play before teaching somebody else how to play the game. Mm-hmm. Or if you're just looking for a challenge, because the solitaire game really isn't that easy.
No, I wouldn't think it would be. Well, I'm going to cooperate with myself.
I hate myself. Finally, there's some optional rules to make the game easier or more difficult, or even just to add some new challenges to the game. Overall, Castle Panic is a fun time and makes a great family game. It can be played in an hour and could easily be taught to those 8 and up. I thought the rules were very well done, and they really did provide a lot of examples that would clear up any questions. Plus, the expansion Wizard's Tower just came out, so I'll have more info on that later.
Cool.
It's not really a gamer's game, you know? You're not going to bring it out with the guy.
Well, sure, it's a family game, but you could probably, through your own imagination, I suppose, make it more for adults.
Right.
You know?
Like Castle Panic?
Yes. There you go. Strip Castle Panic. Oh, your tower went down, so do your pants. No, not like Strip Castle Panic. Oh, yeah, it's a family game, so, you know, we got to somehow get dirty about it.
It seemed to me more of a family thing, and it really got everybody kind of working together because we would plan, like, okay, wait, here, you take this card, and since this monster is going to move here at the end of my turn, you'll be able to use this card to stop him. And so it's like a whole mm-hmm. intro co-op game.
Sure.
Which I thought was pretty nice.
Cool. Very good. I know it's a popular game, so that's very cool.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Thanksgiving Day brought about the 100th game release from Victory Point Games. That's right, 100 games.
Holy cow.
And that game was Leipzig 20, designed by Lance McMillan. What began at the Battle of Dresden and continued to unfold on battlefields across the German states, including Culm, Dennewitz, Grossbeeren, Gorlitz, and the Kasbach River, have all led up to this. Four Allied nations and their four armies are converging on Napoleon's Grand Army as it falls back to its supply base at Leipzig. More than 500,000 soldiers will stand and face each other over these fateful days, which are now yours to command in this epic installment of VPG's venerable Napoleonic 20 series. The Battle of Nations awaits. Featuring a strategic scale with core-sized units and multi-hour game turns, play moves smartly across this, the largest single game map in the series. Helping to tell the narrative of this great battle are new types of event cards, and the inclusion of strategy cards allowing players to choose their pre-battle disposition and set their overall plan. This tense and ever-growing meeting engagement will require skill and strategic sense to master. Innovations to this game series include the addition of leader units, whose command span shows the limits of leadership over such a sprawling battlefield. Also, to show the prolonged effects of keeping troops committed to battle, a simple fatigue system has been added to keep players thinking about resting their weary forces over the multiple days of fighting. Can you recreate Napoleon's victory at Leipzig, or can you turn the tide with the four Allied nations? It's for you to decide in BPG's Leipzig 20, available at victorypointgames.com. My understanding is this is the largest game ever published by Victory Point Games.
Really? Well, yeah, largest their, map, you said.
Well, in the series.
Yeah.
That's, from my understanding, I believe it is the biggest.
12 by 17.
It's a monster game. Of course, their big monster game coming up, hopefully this year, is going to be The World Will Hold Its Breath. So I'm keeping tabs on that one because that looks pretty cool.
Cool. Yeah, I'm trying to work on a jingler tagline that sounds good, Woody. At Victory Point Games, where the game plays the thing.
There you have it.
See? There you go.
See, you'll scare people into going to the website.
Ooh.
My next review is Thunderstone Heart of Doom, and it brings the epic struggle introduced in Thunderstone to an epic climax. The expansion adds 7 heroes, 13 village cards, 5 monster groups, 1 treasure set, 3 settings, 3 guardians, and 1 thunderstone.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
La la la. I swear, every time I say thunderstone, I just want to do it like...
Thunderstone!
Me too.
Designed by Mike Elliott and released by AEG this year, it is for 1 to 5 players. Playing time is 45 minutes, and the suggested ages are 12 and up. Heart of Doom, of course, is the latest expansion in the Thunderstone series. Unlike what a lot of people are saying out there, it is not the final Thunderstone game. It's just bringing this story arc to a close. And we're going to actually talk with Jeff Quick, who is in charge of the Thunderstone series over at AEG, right after the first of the year. And we're going to talk about all the big exciting news and exciting titles that are going to be coming in the Thunderstone series in 2012. So anyway, the new expansion adds more monsters, more village cards, and the big baddie himself, Doom.
Doom.
I'm going to assume that listeners already know how to play Thunderstone, so I'm not going to rehash all of the rules. If you don't know how to play Thunderstone, check out our previous reviews, or if you're not interested, just skip ahead to the next review. So Heart of Doom introduces this final boss to the series. Doom is pretty tough, and unlike any other monsters, if you attack him and lose, you lose the game.
Oh, really?
Yep. If you fight him and have other Thunderstones in the deck, you'll get an extra bonus when you attack Doom. But of course, yes. Actually, $6.95. Or as you've been saying, $6.95.
And a can of penicillin.
And a can of penicillin? What?
Oh, never mind.
Now, of course, Doom isn't the only new addition to the expansion. There's new monsters, equipment, treasures, and villagers. People are going to be very happy to find that Heart of Doom does not add any new mechanics to the system, as opposed to other expansions that have come out that have kind of tweaked or made changes to how the game is played. Just because it doesn't add any new mechanics doesn't mean it's just the same old, same old, because it certainly does change a lot of those classic cards. This is really the first expansion since Doomgate Legion that adds something to every expansion, no matter what cards or how many cards are included. I think AEG is really doing something special with this expansion, and to be honest, it's my favorite of the whole bunch. So I'm really looking forward to see what they're going to do with the franchise in the new year.
Yeah.
The highlights, of course, are some of the new cards, and there's quite a few of them that are going to get a lot of play. One is the Chalice Mace, which helps clerics. There's actually 3 clerics included in the expansion, and it has a +3 modifier for the attack, and it provides light when used by a cleric. Another cool weapon is the Jandul Bow. It's a +4 attack into ranks 2 or higher, and lets you swap the position of 2 monsters that are adjacent to each other in the hall.
Oh.
There's also the Short Spear, which gives Militia a special bonus, so you may want to hang on to your Militia cards. There's also new doppelganger monsters that are actually some of the villagers from previous sets. These villagers don't help you, though. They hinder you. Because, they're not really the villagers. They're doppelganger monsters. I think Heart of Doom, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's loads of cool stuff. Like I said, this is probably my favorite expansion to Thunderstone. This really changes things up a bit. Plus, keep in mind, if you go to fight Doom and you lose, boom, that's it. You're done. You've lost.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like fighting any other monster that is out there. I think Heart of Doom is a really nice finale to the current Thunderstone arc. And it adds a lot of great cards. The Heart of Doom scenario is pretty tough, especially if you randomly choose the village cards. A lot of the new heroes gain attacks if you destroy cards. This can be pretty cool, but it can also hurt you in the long run when you need those cards that you destroyed. Just depends on what cards they happen to destroy and how hard those cards might be to replace. Let's be honest here. Is Thunderstone the smoothest playing deck building game out there? No. It can be clunky at times, and when your deck-building strategy blows up in your face, it can even be a bit on the frustrating side. But what the game has in spades is not only an abundance of theme, but also that weird, perverse satisfaction you feel when you put together some oddball strategy And by just that right card combination, you're able to make that dungeon run, knock out some high-value monster, and make it back in one piece. Plus, I don't know of any other deck builder out there that keeps the players as engaged as Thunderstone can. If you own some or all of the Thunderstone expansions, you really should add Heart of Doom to your collection.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I like you're like, yeah. I was like, yeah, as in yes or no? Or
yes, I would like to add Heart of Doom to my collection.
Then go out there and add Heart of Doom to your collection.
Bloop, there, I just clicked it.
That's it? That's all you have to say?
Hey, what do you want me to say?
I don't know.
You know, what am I supposed to say? I
what am
get
I supposed
a chance
to
play
it?
I want to see Doom. I want to see his heart. Since I've heard what you said about it, mm-hmm. I am actually looking forward to being able to play Heart of Doom. It would be nice. I've built it up to this point.
Sure.
I haven't heard of a deck building game having an actual climax before. Not bad. I like that.
What do you mean, not like that? I'm just, what?
You know, coming to an arc.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
So, yeah, that'll actually be cool for me to check out.
And you're right. I don't know of any other deck building games that do have an end.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's just you build it until you're carrying six boxes of cards and you got a stack of randomizers about 4 inches
well,
high.
You know, I take it back. There are deck building games that'll come to an end.
Right,
it's because nobody's buying it. Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. The last expansion was a flop. Nobody bought it. Now they're not coming out with anything else. Sure. But yeah, I thought that was kind of cool too.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if you think about it, AEG is sort of like that. Because if you think about their Legend of the Five Rings collectible card game,
yeah.
Which they're, as a side note, I probably should have mentioned this in the news, their Emperor Edition is hitting stores in January. Looks very, very sweet.
Yeah,
it's going to be a nice way to introduce people to the game as well.
Yeah.
But they do that kind of stuff in their L5R game, where they have story arcs for the boosters and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they do.
And then they release something new, which is an all-new story. AEG's kind of like that, as opposed to, yeah, here's some more cards, buy these cards, get these cards. There's a bit of a narrative involved in it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they'll move along the same lines in Nightfall.
Could be, I don't know.
We'll have to ask him.
I don't know. I was going to say Nightfall to me seems a bit more open-ended, would you agree, than Thunderstone?
Well, the way it's been going so far, yeah. I mean, Blood Country is an outdoorsy theme. I mean, they do come up with different themes for each one, but I guess
sure.
They all do.
Right. Well, of course.
My next review is on The Adventurers, The Pyramid of Horus from Fantasy Flight Games. Just came out, I believe, back at Gen Con.
Did it release at Gen Con?
I think I wanted to buy it at Gen Con. Maybe it didn't release, but soon afterwards then.
Okay.
It's for 2 to 6 players, ages 13 and up. Takes less than an hour to play. Sometimes much less.
Sometimes it takes longer to set it up than to play.
Now, The Adventurers and the Pyramid of Horus is the standalone sequel to The Adventurers and the Temple of Chak, or Chak. I think it's Chak. The first game was a tough, fun game with smashing walls, a rolling boulder, a collapsing bridge, and tiles that sink into a lava pit.
Wasn't there a river you could fall into, too?
Yeah, that was the collapsing bridge.
Oh, okay, sorry.
It was easy enough to get killed that they gave you a second character to use if your first character was killed off early. Well, the fun is back in the Pyramid of Horus, with a few changes, some for the better and some for the worse. In this version, you are racing in and out of an Egyptian pyramid. Along the way, you will face poisonous snakes and scorpions, crocodiles, mummies, and a collapsing ceiling. The object is the same. You run in, grab as many treasures as you can, and get out before the collapsing ceiling traps you in the pyramid forever. I'm not as impressed with the components of Pyramid as I was with the original.
Really?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. They are high quality, but most of the box is taken up with these 36 plastic blocks that slowly take over the board. There are nice figures, and the three mummy figures look great. There are character cards, many smaller treasure cards, some colored base clip-ons that you can put on the bottom of your character. I don't know. So that you can say, well, I'm
like
red.
Clip-on ties? There's just a little snap-on so you can color code the
pieces. Yeah, they snap onto the base.
Okay.
Okay.
And five colored dice. What? No boulder? How about sliding walls? No. Okay, what about the snakes? Those are on cards. What about the scorpions? Well, those are on cards. The alligators? No, those are on cards too. There are the mummies.
What about the collapsing ceiling?
That's those 36 plastic blocks.
I assume that, yeah.
But I was disappointed overall that it wasn't as flashy as the original.
Okay.
Now, that's not to say it's a bad game. In the original, one false move and you were dead. You then had to wait until a certain moment in the game to pull your other character in. And by then, your biggest concern was to get out alive. In Pyramid, you take wounds. The wounds count towards the amount of stuff that you can carry. As in the first game, you get a certain number of actions each turn that's based on the roll of the dice and the amount of treasure you were carrying. Carrying too much, you move like a snail, ensuring your swift demise.
Mm-hmm.
The wounds that you take add to that weight rather than kill you, so you get to play the full game with one character, but you'll get slower and slower as time goes on. Now, the pyramid itself is basically one big room separated into a couple of sections. You go in the same door.
Like the collapsing one?
Get out. Yes. So there's no need to worry about working your way through a maze to get to the exit.
Or is there? I don't know. Is there?
Each turn, you roll the dice and determine the number of actions everyone gets based on the amount you're carrying. You can move or search with each action. You can move one square, search, move another square. That's your actions. When you finish up with your actions, you roll the dice and move the mummies. The mummies wander up and down the corridors lining three sides of the pyramid. Then you select a block at random from the box, flip it over, and see which number is on it. And then you place it in the corresponding numbered square on the board.
Okay.
If someone is unlucky enough to be in that square, they get smashed by the block and they take a wound. Unless there's nowhere for them to jump to, like no adjacent open space, then they're just dead. The important thing to remember is that the characters can't move diagonally. You have to work your way around the blocks orthogonally. If at any time your path is completely blocked by the falling stones, you're trapped and the game's over for you.
Do you need me to add some additional background music here to kind of build the tension? No, go ahead.
One note about the blocks.
Dun, dun,
there are numbered stickers provided that you place on the underside of each block. The only problem... The only problem is that the 6 and the 9 are identical. So I recommend underlining them so you can tell the difference between them. Yes, I realize there's a small discoloration in the corner of one of the stickers, but it's barely noticeable, so I'd go with the underlining. The first section in the game is a cobra's nest, and searching here allows you to draw a card from the rubble deck. It might be a snake, though, which gains you a bite.
Which is a wound.
Which is a wound, yes. Similarly, the scorpion pit and the crocodile pond work the same way and have their own decks to draw from, which can earn you a bite or a sting. The treasures get progressively better as you get deeper into the pyramid, but you have to be able to get out again. Now, the mummy's corridor, which lines the temple on three sides, is where you can open up sarcophagus and raid them for treasure. Or you can try to get one of the five idols that are on the walls. The mummies walk up and down these corridors, though, and if they come in contact with your adventurer, you'll take another wound that you can't get rid of. At least all of the other wounds can be removed by different pieces of equipment that you can also find in the treasure decks. The equipment is another new feature in this version. These can help you in different ways by removing wounds or even help you predict where the next block will fall, which comes in pretty handy sometimes. The characters all have special abilities that you can use once per game, which is similar to the abilities that were in the original game. And that's all there is to it. You run in, you grab what you can, and get out before the blocks stop you from escaping. The player with the most treasure who makes it out alive wins the game. When I first started playing the game, I thought that the mummies moved and the blocks dropped after each player takes their actions, and this led to really fast gains and games with four or more players basically ending in 3 to 5 turns. It was really thrilling and tense, and the pressure was really on. I mean, you had to just run in there, and the blocks are falling, and you just grab what you could and ran back out. We never even made it to the back wall unless it was a 2 or 3 player game. Because, of course, the more players, the more blocks that are dropping.
Sure.
Then I was looking something up in the rules, and I realized we were playing it completely wrong.
Don't you love when you do that?
Yeah. It's like, oh, my God. So after all the players take their actions, then the mummies move, and the block drops. This really took the pressure off, and the game started lasting the full 45 minutes rather than the 20 minutes I had grown accustomed to. Unfortunately, the excitement level did drop a bit. The mummies are hardly a threat at all, and they're easy to avoid. And it suddenly seemed like we had all the time in the world to get what we wanted and get out. And the survival rate jumped substantially. Hey, okay, I might recommend trying it the other way. Just to get the super tense excitement of...
Get the juices flowing.
I'm telling you, 20 minutes, especially with two or three players, I enjoyed it. It still moves fast enough to get several games in, and it's fun, don't get me wrong. Get too greedy, and you'll never finish at all, just like in the original. It has more random chances. You can never tell when the game will end. It's all up to the luck of the draw for the blocks. The game could last four turns, or 25. You just don't know. It's a good game with some nice changes, but if you're going to compare it to the original, I think it's more of a Jaws 2 than a Godfather Part 2.
Jaws 2 was horrible.
I thought Jaws 2 was all right. That was the one with the big cable. Shark comes up.
Bites it, yeah, and it's electrocuted. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I recall that much.
But, you know, it didn't win Best Picture like Godfather Part 2.
It sounds like you were pretty disappointed in the components and everything, though.
I was because, you know, the first one, you had all these different types of things. And this one, the whole center of the box is filled with these big gray blocks that you put stickers on. Yeah, I was looking for a little more. That's basically, you know, the blocks fall, you run in, you run out.
Do you think the fault lies with Fantasy Flight or does it lie with Dust Games?
I kind of thought from what I had read that because it's designed by the same guys who did the first one, Dust Games. And so I think it goes to Dust Games, but I really have no idea. I'm not saying the components are bad. It's just I was spoiled by the first one with all the, because I thought the sliding walls coming together was really cool.
Sure, and you had the big boulder. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I remember your review of it.
For this, it, you know, just a bunch of big blocks that fill up the entire middle of the box. And then everything
and some
else
figures
is cards.
And counters, you know. Oh, cards, yeah. Okay.
Throw me a couple of snakes in there that are going to pop on the board, or, you know. Alligators. Everything else is cards, and it takes a while to set the whole thing up because you got to split up all these cards.
You're not just grabbing a little figure out of the box.
Right. You have to find this one specific card that goes in this spot on the board, and you got to find this one specific card that goes in this spot on the board. Kind of like that. So it takes you a little bit of time to split up this 2-inch stack of cards into their proper spaces on the board. It was still enjoyable. Especially turbo version.
But it's funny how you mentioned, oh, and then we find out we were playing it wrong. Yeah, that happens to all of us. Good thing I played Cargo Noir that one last time because it was going to get a really bad review. And I went, oh, yeah. Misunderstood that final scoring part. Gotcha.
Now I get it.
Our final review on the show is going to be High Noon Saloon. On a winding desert road in the middle of nowhere lies a town with no name. In this town, you'll find a place where no slight goes unanswered, no fight stays private. The roughest, toughest watering hole in the old west.
Rudest, tootest, shootinest.
I was waiting for that one. It's the High Noon Saloon. If you're looking for a fight, you've come to the right place. Designed by Cliff Baum, Jeff Batone. That's a guess, folks.
Hey, after all the names I've massacred in this show.
I do it all the time, too. As well as Jeff Morrow with art by Beth Trott. It is published by Slugfest Games, came out this year. It's for 2 to 6 players. You can play it in about 45 minutes, and the suggested ages are 10 and up. It's no surprise that High Noon Saloon is a brawling game. So each player is going to take a character, and each character, you've got a real small mounted map of this saloon with various different areas. And each area of the saloon can provide you with bonuses to your attacks or bonuses to your defense, possibly both or none of the above. Each player will also have a hand of cards, and the cards consist of different modifiers to their attacks and modifiers to their defense. One thing that really stands out about High Noon Saloon is the artwork. That's why I mentioned the art is by Beth Trott. I really like the art. And it's sort of funny, and I'm going to date myself here, but, and I don't mean I'm going out to dinner sure. with myself, but yeah, well, I do that all the time anyway. The artwork reminded me of, and I know, Elliot, you'll probably remember this, back in the day when Steve Jackson Games was doing things like Car Wars, and they had those cardboard heroes
mm-hmm.
that were the little stand-ups you could use for miniatures for your role-playing games and things like that. They had this specific art style that was sort of comic bookish but realistic at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not kind of silly, goofy. This is the same kind of art. I really like the artwork. There are four male characters. There are four female characters for you to choose from. I don't know how many women really got into all-out brawls in the middle of the Old West, but hey, you know, what can I say? It's, I would say, a filler game. I don't know if it's really going to take a full 45 minutes to play. Maybe with six players it could. I would think you should be able to crank it out in about 30 minutes, maybe even less than that. It really breaks down to each player draws cards. They're able to have one weapon in their holster. They're able to have one weapon in their hand. There are firearms and there are melee weapons. So when you attack, you get to choose if you're going to use your gun or if you're going to use your knife or tomahawk, or you can use your gun for a melee attack as well.
You can use a chair.
Nothing like, no. Hey, come on. You got a pistol? Pistol whip that guy.
You can't use a bottle of whiskey?
No, you'd be drinking that. What are you talking about? Although, interestingly enough, if you're hiding behind the bar, you get to add a point to your grit, which is effectively your hit points or your health.
Oh, cool.
Pretty much plays out until there's just one person standing. That's whoever still has grit left at the end of the game. The attacks take away grit. The basic game is pretty basic. Every character plays out the same exact way. There is an advanced game where you flip over your character card and there are some additional bonuses that each one will get. Some are stronger, some are better with weapons and things like that.
I have a high prostitution score. Come on, did you ever see Deadwood?
Did I ever see Deadwood? I was the guy who turned you on to
the
Deadwood.
The women in the saloon.
Yes, I know all about
okay,
it.
Go ahead.
I got it. I get it. No, there are no whores in the game as far as I remember. Oh, there's like Annie Oakley kind of character. There's a kind of like a cowgirl. What do you think? It's the cowboys and the prostitutes fighting it out?
Wasn't that a movie that just came out?
Alien versus Predator versus cowboys versus prostitutes. Yes. Yeah. All in all, I think High Noon Saloon's fun. It's not a game changer by any stretch of the imagination. It's a fun beat-em-up where you can get together with your friends and just kind of whoop it up for a half hour or so. I don't know. I'd say it's about a 7 overall. There's not a lot to it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it has to do with what cards you have in your hand, the cards that you draw. And you can move around to the different areas as long as there's space for you to go into that area. There are rules involved where you can play as teams. So everybody doesn't have to be everybody for themselves. You can play it where you have a team and the team actually shares a grit pool. So the team that is the last team that has grit left is the winner. So that's an option as well. So you can create a bit of a co-op atmosphere to the game.
Hmm.
All in all, it's a fun diversion and it's got fantastic art.
Okay, cool.
So High
Noon Saloon. I've been wanting to do this.
High Noon Saloon.
That was supposed to be a good Ben Yagley.
That sounds, yeah, it sounds nothing like
you're
that.
Right.
It's,
you take that.
To be honest, no, I'm going to leave that in. It sounded like you were strangling a goose. The hell
get
are
down,
you doing
Chelveston.
Over there, man? Chelveston, Ray Rayner. There you mm-hmm. go. All right. So there we pretty much have it. There was one last note that I did want to mention. I did run a bit of a quick charity auction over on Board Game Geek over the past weekend. It only ran for about 3 days. I wasn't going to make a big deal of it. That's just not the kind of guys that we are. There'll be a little more detail about it. All the winners and everything. I promised I was going to announce their names on one of our upcoming shows. So I'll talk about the auction in a little more depth on our next program and announce the winners. Interestingly enough, one of the prizes, I guess we would say, that was up for bidding was to be in a segment with us, a 15-minute segment for the podcast.
Yeah, it went for a lot, like $2.50, right?
It went for $1.39 is what it fit. No, No, it, actually, I was surprised that it went for $25.
That's surprising.
Which
that's cool.
Which was a lot higher than some of the games that I had put up there. And I just wanted to point out that, you know, outside of a couple of copies of Frontline General Spearpoint 1943 that are signed by our pal Byron Collins over at Collins Epic War Games. By the way, get over to Kickstarter and check out that terrain set. Looks pretty cool for mm-hmm. that. Everything was from my collection. So this wasn't stuff that we had donated and, you know, we were doing an auction for. Because as I had mentioned to Elliot, I'm just throwing this out there. I don't think it's very difficult for you to give away stuff that doesn't belong to you in the first place. I don't know. So overall, about $800 is what was raised over the 3 days or so. So pretty yep. cool.
And what was the charity you should mention?
Yes, the charity is for the Sunshine Acres Children's Home located here in Mesa, Arizona. And I'll talk a bit more about that as well on the following
very
show.
Cool.
Was there anything else you wanted to add to the mix, Mr. Elliot?
Nah, I think I'm good.
You got to get back to strangling the goose.
Well, if that's what you want to call it.
Oh, ouch. There aren't too many games out there that go to a climax. All right, enough of our nonsense. Everybody, thanks for listening. We'll be back next time. Elliot, care to take us out?
Sure will.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.